Nine of nine. So let's get these in order. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So they're all in reverse order. Okay.
Yeah.
So I these are in order in which I drew them out by hand initially, because the whole set never changed. And I guess I'll just Well, it's a little problem getting them handled. I guess it'll be less of a problem this way. So, multi-layer main logic board PCB schematic. This is for the Osborne 1.
Okay, and it says release to manufacturing.
Let's see, issued George Waldron. I remember him. He was sort of the number two or number three engineer hired by Ed Richter, who was the VP for engineering after I gave it up. So here we have the clock oscillator, which is initially 16 megahertz and now is 15.9744 megahertz. Reset circuit loop. Two inverter flip-flop with a SPDT switch and a reset pulse generator. We have a divider that divides down. First, it sends out the 16 megahertz clock, divides it by two to get the dot clock for the videos, or clocking at 8 megahertz. Now we've got the CPU clock at 4 megahertz, the memory clock at 2 megahertz, and the character clock at 1 megahertz. Very nice and simple. One synchronous counter. Over here we've got interrupt logic, IRQ0, IRQ2, and probably IRQ1. Coming in and ORing together, basically, to get to the interrupt. And then they are identified by data bits that are enabled onto data bits 0, 1, 2, and 3 by the interrupt interrupt acknowledge signal. And then we have some power input, and the battery connector has some diodes that are there for, to block current coming in the reverse direction.
Okay.
Page 2. Here's the clock driver, these two transistors, Q1 and Q2. That takes the CPU clock and simply drives it with enough force to keep the get the levels that get to the levels that you require for a Z80 CPU, and ideally do it without overshooting, without much overshooting.
Well, hold on, I'm going to turn this to a lower quality and run out of memory. Perfect.
And yet, you look at these pictures, and you see how just that one simple act, jumping up in the air, and the way they did it, expressed so much of what we come to think of their personality.
Just, we have enough space.
But the art there was, it's not the medium of the photography, but that she got them to do it, and right. Hit that button, and just try and capture.
Going down to the bottom, we have this ROM CE chip-enabled generator circuit, which is an LS139 decoder, which takes address 13 and 14, and it decodes it with zero to get you the Y0 output. There is a decode of one, which would be address 13 equal to one, address 14, zero. And both of them are enabled by address 15 equal to 0. So the 0 page, plus a signal called ROM mode. So the thing would initialize almost certainly in ROM mode. And then when you've got your booting done, it turns the ROM off. So the other than ROM CE generates the I.O. request, so we're getting I.O. and I.O. space in there.
Right, right.
That all is dependent upon ROM mode. So I.O. accesses apparently don't happen unless it's in ROM mode.
Right.
So you've got the whole RAM available space, and then I.O. space and ROM space gets addressed over it. Now you have MREC, memory request, and read coming in and being added to generate the ROM read,
right,
which is also Well, that's it. I mean,
that's it. And this is on sheet one, just for the audio.
Sheet two.
Sheet two. Yeah, we're on sheet two of multi-layer main logic PCB schematic.
Yes, right. So, of course, since ROM read won't have any effect unless the ROM CE is active, the ANDing for that happens inside the ROM chip. Now we have the another. See, either of these pages, I think, has an input to the CPU or the memory access timing.
Right.
The memory access timing is centered around UD3, which is an LS161 synchronous counter. And I was very good at designing these sequential circuits around synchronous counters.
Mm-hmm.
The trick with the Z80 was that it had a, and still has, a refresh, memory refresh cycle following each memory access cycle. And there were certain exceptions to that. And I used the memory refresh cycle to not only cycle the memory, but also to get video data out of the memory. And because the video data would be have a guaranteed to have 128 addresses, that's why the video data had 128 columns.
Right.
And we had a window of 52 columns that could move across that 128 column space. So the circuit did, there's an access and CPU time signal coming out of the memory timer, and I believe, and I'll find out this out later, that access governed access to the video. You have an M1 signal that comes out of the, there's an M1 from the, which should come from the processor. I mean, that's coming from page 3, which is the
right.
Next one.
And let's take a look at the CPU here.
That's,
here we go. I got very little video left, so I'm going to get you talking about the Z80 here.
Yeah, well, the Z80.
Oops, sorry about that. Let me get you on video here. Okay, it's 3, 2, 1, start.
Okay, the Z80 now has had the CPU clock develop, the interrupt signal coming in. There's a wait signal which does come in from that memory interface.
Mm-hmm.
So that there were times when you had to put the processor on wait when it was doing a video access. We have a signal M1 which apparently was output by the memory timing, yes. And there's an M1 star, which is a status signal. No, that's got an input to the Z80.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to find the source for that. And I don't think I can, because these are not inputs. These are outputs.
These are outputs.
So there's an M1 state on the part of the processor. And that governs what happens with the I.O. and so forth. We have decoders at UD10, which look for write and M1 or write and not M1, well, 1 and 2, as well as an I.O. request. In other words, I.O. request was be on during certain times, having to do with interrupts, for instance.
Right,
yeah. We have some flip-flops here and a decoder with a little latch, which would generate this bit 9. Bit 9 goes to the next page, and we'll see more about that.
Yeah, okay. See how it fits together.
We get ROM mode determined by this flip-flop, UB4, section B. And it is driven by a, this is a chain of, a shift register chain.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's not clocked in common. The clocks are conditional upon certain circumstances like ROM mode.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a continuation of the memory and the CPU access controller here. You know, somebody can work out the timing diagram of this. I don't remember it. The CPU has 16 address bits that it puts out. And we get 0 and 1 going back here to these, this decoder.
Right.
It has the data bits, which are bidirectional. It has a ROM, which is close up to it, and some pull-up resistors for when those data bits pull up. I see R45 going to plus 5, which is interesting. Why is it not one of these RN1s? Maybe there weren't enough in the package for that. For instance, if it's an 8-pin package, it would have only 7 resistors in the common.
Right,
I think that's more like what happened.
Yeah.
So the ROM gets the address bits. It gets the ROM chip enable, the ROM read enable, and there it is. So you have the data bus 0 through 7, address bus 0 through 15 going out. And we have a memory request signal, which includes the standard MREC from the processor or refresh, because we're doing the video access during the refresh.
Yeah.
Typically, in a non-video system, it would do an access, but it wouldn't really complete the access. It would be enable signal.
So
here on page 4, we have the memory array. It's a dynamic memory array.
Yeah.
16K chips by 1 bit, 4 banks of them. And we have some resistor networks here that for the addresses to prevent overshoot. We have some resistor networks on the CAS and RAS signals, again, to prevent overshoot. That's very important.
Right.
And then we have a resistor network set of networks here in the data lines, which had to run most of the way across the board. And I put those resistor networks in the middle of the board because data should be coming both directions. Now, this is a 244, which is a unidirectional driver, so I'm not seeing that here, but I know we were getting data driven back from this memory array.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, we had to put the resistor network in there to make it work reliably, because otherwise we've got too much ringing, overshoot, and so forth on the data bus. We have the multiplexers, LS153, which are 4-to-1 multiplexers. There are 4 of them. And they're giving you the generating the address bits A0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 to the memory. We have another address bit, which is, there are only 7 address bits to the memory. That's it. So now they also create A0, which, all right, that we counted that. So there are 4 possible sources for those addresses. Now, dynamic memory works with a dual memory addressing multiplexing. First, you feed the row address, you strobe the row access strobe, RAS. Then you change to the column address and strobe the column address. Well, now we're accessing this for both a video and standard memory.
Really low cost. I mean, this is a real cost reduction.
Sure.
Method, yeah.
Well, the whole thing was to be very low cost.
Low cost. Under $2,000, I guess, for everything.
$1,795 was the retail price for this. So the cost of it had to be in the region of $200 or less.
Wow.
If I recall correctly.
Wow.
It might have been $250. Unsure about that.
Now, these schematics are from May of 82, so they would be another production to the factory? Or?
Well, no. Now, first of all, production was going on continuously starting in June of 81. This is simply a re-documentation, and may very well mean to be a re-layout of the board, because at that time, when Waldron was involved, one of their main tasks was to get it to be FCC approvable.
Right.
The rules were new in those days. What we put out was not done with any regard to FCC,
right.
And so they had to relay out the board.
Okay.
So I don't recognize the numbering system, the UE, UD, UA. Maybe these are A, B, C, D on a grid.
Right.
I think it might have been. I didn't do that in the initial layout. I could be wrong, but I don't think I did. So really, it's just a redocumentation after a relayout.
Some of these hand, is this your handwriting?
It is not my handwriting.
Not your handwriting.
No, it's probably Waldron's handwriting.
Waldron, okay.
Because he approved it.
Blodgett's
the draftsman.
Blodgett's the draftsman, okay.
Yeah. He did the drawing of the stuff you see in blue here. Then it's passed over to the engineer, who would be Waldron in that case. And he
marks it up. So this is a markup print. This is not the final print.
Right, okay.
We have the a latch here that takes the video data out. The clock for that is... Where's that clock coming from?
Age. What the hell is
yeah,
this?
Well, at least he can see this big this age. Okay. I'm trying to find where the clock came from because...
What is it?
Oh, this is an output. This is the Osborne schematics.
Oh, yeah.
That piece of work. Yeah. You know what you were going to say. Okay, so it's coming the other way. See, I would not have drawn it with this multiplexer pointing to the left. I was a draftsman for 2 months.
Data went that way.
Data went left to right.
Shit rolled downhill.
It's got to flow like a diarrhea. John DeCesar trained me in this. Guy who penciled a mustache on his face. So we got the latch and the character generator ROM, which I developed the character's font for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the clock is 8 megahertz and not 16, because we had to double the dots. One dot was just not going to be seen. And if I'm not mistaken, I thought we had a character with one dot in it, but I don't know. I guess it was supposed to be just a blur. It's the center of the W. And then we have the LS-166 shift register, which I've been using ever since the VDM. Fine little synchronous loading shift register. And that feeds out the video. We get driven by the dot clock and loaded by horizontal count, which happens every character. But it's a pulse. Do not mix manufacturers in RAM logic, it says down there. I didn't say that.
Who wrote this command? Is that your baby or someone else's?
Someone else was engineering this at the point.
Oh, okay.
At that point.
All right.
Hey, this
oh, yeah,
is,
that's right. I'm quite sure what they had.
This is number... Are we on number four?
We're number five.
Number five, okay.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah. So here we have the IO. We have 6821, which is a Motorola chip.
Right.
It's basically a PIO chip. It's just a big latch, essentially. It's got a bunch of, addresses that make up chip selects. So we're using the internal logic to do the decode there.
Sure, yeah.
Now this gets you, this is a latch that determines the CH address and TX address, meaning the... We did some vertical scrolling too,
mm-hmm.
but mostly it was horizontal scrolling, CH address. And these then go into LS-161 counters. So here are your horizontal address counters. The
binary or decimal?
Binary. So those are going to the multiplexer for the memory address. So during the video address time, this source is the horizontal address and a vertical address too, TX address.
Mm-hmm.
You got 5 bits for that. And there's a couple of other pins, drive one and drive two. I think those are for the disk drive selection.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a general parallel port. We did timing interface, or timing circuit, was the e-clock generator here, character clock, I guess that's what it is, that made the whole thing, that chip, work. And people would come up to me at some point and say, well, one of the examples of things you can't do is to use Motorola chips with Intel chips. Haha, I did it.
You did it.
And they're real cheap.
Yeah.
So moving down here, we got, let's see, cursor, H count. So here's some... So here's the video output circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
So the video dots coming in, and the cursor information comes in. We're clocking this on the H count, which is the character clock, and ordering it together. And there's a dim bit, which I could go to a lower intensity. And so we have this UE21 is the sort of last stage of clocking before it went out as the video. And we have this open collector 7406 high current syncing capability inverters that work with the resistors R37, 38, 39, 40, and 41. Basically, the 39, 38, 37 is the chain that produces the video out, and have a little pot that you can select for the contrast. That had to be a 75 ohm output or something close to it. Now we got the blanking signals that come in to UE23, but those are implemented through gates UE22. I tried on the original VDM1 to implement that blanking out in the analog output of this circuit, but
yeah.
You could see the video coming through it.
Right.
The little wrinkles.
Little wrinkles, yeah.
Were perfectly visible.
It's like the word Christensen modem protocol where you can see all the characters that are being transmitted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have now, in the center of the image, we have some LS393s. These are binary counters that are providing, let's see, 2 and 4 microsecond timing signals. There's a flip-flop that provides horizontal blanking. So these are some of the horizontal, the blanking timing. It's an asynchronous ripple counter.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't too worried about that because we're picking it up with like this latch LS174 UD14 clocked by the 62 nanosecond, a sort of sub-dot clock. And let's see. We also have the LS390, which is a decimal counter, which does the scan counting. That's for the character generator.
Mm-hmm.
So we would then, this would be clocked at, simply clocked on a modulo 10. So there were 10 scan lines on it per character line.
Right, yeah.
We see one more of them that goes to the UB14, another counter. So I guess that's yet another. Let's see, clear. We got it. Well, this whole thing gets cleared out at certain times.
Yeah.
But I don't know exactly under what circumstances. Okay, so the vertical blanking and so forth is that.
Yep.
Moving on to page 6. We have.
Yeah, look at all this cascading.
These
circuitry
go
here.
Out. Well, these are disk interface.
Oh, this is the disk interface.
So okay. We have the 74 LS, LS03, I thought it would be 38, open collector NANDs. And we have 6.8K pull-ups. Well, this is odd because if this were going out to the disk cable, it would have to be able to cable a driving 150 ohms.
Right.
So I'm beginning to wonder, I mean, I don't see what else this could be. Because we have, let's see, a 6821, another PIO,
mm-hmm.
with data latch. Oh, I know what's going on here. This is not the disk interface. This is the I.O.
This is the I.O.
This was supposed to be originally an IEEE 488 interface.
Okay.
And we had someone who was like the brother of Barbara Van Burdick, now Zelnick, who eventually married Adam for a while.
Okay.
In San Diego, was writing the software for this, and so I worked, collaborated with him on that. So we've got two of these drivers, sort of bidirectional, to drive this I/O port, this parallel I/O port.
Right.
And the pull-ups were for that, and we have similar signals: NDAC, EO1, DAVNR, FD, SRQ, ATN, IFC, RN. All of these are IEEE 488 signals. So that's what this page does. This is the parallel I/O port.
Okay.
There's a note down here, Testology Shorting. Testology is the company that was building them.
Okay.
They were the assemblers, and they did an initial test.
Okay.
And the test development.
The sheet,
it was not well coordinated.
Sheet 7?
All right. 6850, this is a serial interface. Whether it's a U, I think it's a U, a, it's, they call it ACIA, A for asynchronous. So this asynchronous interface, there's a clock divider with the 4 and 2 microsecond signals going in there to give you the right baud rate clock.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, divided down internally by 4 or something. We got 300 baud and 1200 baud out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked this off of the horizontal. The video timing chain. We've got the data bus coming in. We got some address bus, I/O select.
Right, there it all is.
The character clock being the E signal, the 1 microsecond clock. Pardon me. Got interrupts coming out of it, write signal going in. And there's a modem RI signal, ring indicator, that just goes through and out again. But this goes out to the modem connector.
That's interesting. We've got a little story about that. We're using operational amplifiers, 3900. These are current mode op amps for the RS-232 interface. We have received data coming in, as well as RTS coming in. It goes to the DCD input. So they've got the we've got some hysteresis here with the positive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of 1458, which is a voltage mode op amp, very common one for the RS-232 output, and it's being run open loop.
Okay.
We just have a divider that sets thresholds, and we have a charge pump, a 555 timer UE1, whose purpose is to provide a negative 5 volt, approximately 5 volt signal. And so that is used by the, it's used through R30 by the 1458 to provide a negative voltage for RS-232. We have the modem connector. Now, initially, I had another page on the circuit that was a penny whistle modem.
Penny whistle, right.
Which was redesigned for, it would have been the same. I think we were had to have the frequencies the other way, but I'm not sure. This was not for use at the other end of the line. Anyway, there wasn't room in the circuit board for that. So we just threw that page away and took all the signals that were going out to it and put them on a connector.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this MSB, which is the RTS signal, CTS similarly, 12 volts, RX data, MCB, and TX data, and R1. So the R1, I believe, is a generalized control bit, the only control bit. I called it OLB, which stood for one lousy bit. And when Tom Hogan, who was writing the manual, got to it, he said, "What does it mean?" I said, "It means one lousy bit. We can't say that." So he came up with something called output low bit. And that's in the manual.
Okay.
But here it's called R1.
Yeah, yeah.
And we worked out a control system for external modems in which we would give different frequencies of bursts through it. So there's the circuit here. Page
8. There we go.
All right.
Pretty simple page.
Yeah. This is keyboard.
Keyboard, okay.
Yeah. We had a keyboard. It was a totally passive matrix. And we had the rows being scanned by the address bits, address 0 through 7.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take data back in through a tri-state driver with pull-ups. Now, in order to accommodate the capacitance of the keyboard, which would delay the rise of the signals coming back, we used a fairly a very obscure feature of the Z80, in which you did a certain kind of I/O instruction, and it put out the address that it was. Well, then you did the same instruction for the next one, and the higher the address lines had been set and didn't change, so that gave it extra time to rise. If you didn't do that, if you did it all in one instruction, there wasn't time; it was not reliable.
Right.
So that's all that's going on here. We have a little bit of I/O logic. Now down here we have disk select, which comes in from address 11 and address 8, and I/O select. Disk read enable, disk write enable, and our ubiquitous character clock, which is actually generated here, well, it's by inverting character clock. It's just an inverse. So that's, again, a 1 megahertz signal. So that will go. Let's get to the next page.
We've got our last page 9 here.
Page 9, a disk controller.
Disk controller. It
says so right here.
Yeah.
And this is a 1793. I thought we used a 765, but this is a 1793 controller. I think from National, I'm not sure. And we have, again, let's see now, character clock shows up here because that's a 1 megahertz clock for it. And it'll select and read enables. So we just have the signals going out, step, direct, direction, index coming back in. We use 7406s to drive the 150 ohm terminations.
Mm-hmm.
We have an LS161 here, memory clock. Let's see, what's that generating? That is generating a read clock to the
to the disk controller, and there's some ready output from there that has some changes this timing a little bit. I don't remember that exactly how that works. We have a two-stage shift register, but they don't have a common clock. One is the CPU clock, so they're sort of reclocking this, apparently. But that generates the raw read signal.
Right.
I'm not sure what that is.
How many chips was the disk controller using?
We see it right here. It's one chip.
One chip.
It's one LSI chip with 40 pins.
Right.
We've got one LS161 counter. We got
two
flip-flops, which is in one chip.
Right.
And we've got the UA10 and here's more UA10 and UA9. Two 7406 high current drivers. Parts of an LS244. It's a 2, 3, 4. Go right ahead. So that's half of a 244 buffer. As I say, we have two inverters and one LS74, two sections of it, and one 161. So that's the disk controller. We designed the board on the other end of that, but it could have run with commercial boards. We used the same circuit, same timing, and same approximate circuits, only a few quirks. So, but we were building that board supposedly to save money. Adam said we'll use raw metal disk drives that we can get real cheap.
Right.
And the problem was they still had to be aligned, and nobody really understood that until we started production. And whoops, we need to align the disks. And so this empty space that was going to be marketing started filling up with workbenches of people busy turning pots and adjusting the disks. So, oh yes, it didn't last though.
So
what else can I tell you?
So this is the story of the Osborne 1 schematics, sheet 1-9, as told by Lee Felsenstein.
Stein. My name is
Felsenstein. Lee Felsenstein, and thank you very much. These came through Greg McNichol, and I have to find out who he got them through, so maybe there's a source of more Osborne stuff. Who knows?
I'm sure there's plenty of lore.
Is there any other schematics around, you know, that have survived? Or?
Well, I donated all of my schematics to the Green Library at Stanford.
Okay.
If there was anything there from this time, it would be there, but I think all the stuff that I had from then were given to Osborne.
To Osborne.
We might have had something that came back from Osborne at that point. I don't know. You may want to check. The papers of Lee Felsenstein.
Okay. Thank you, Lee. Thank you very, very much.
You're most welcome.
For the DigiBarn Radio, this is Bruce Damer, signing off. Bye-bye.